you guys. Snap season one, episode 13.
The last episode.
Holy moly. We did season one, y'all. Can't believe it.
In the books.
In the books, yeah. It's, I mean, you can't find it really either. So hopefully we're doing it justice. And if you ever get a chance to watch it, you know. So do.
The good news is, since it's so hard to find, if we're not doing it justice, none of y'all are going to know.
That's right.
Just kidding. If you do have a chance to watch it, it's pretty interesting.
Yeah. I mean, definitely, I'm a fan of, I mean, we probably started watching this show maybe more like 2007, 2008, I feel like. So these early episodes are just so short. And
not the Snap that we all know and love.
Yeah, it's just, and Sharon Martin isn't narrating it yet, so she's our queen.
She's our OG.
Yeah. All right. This is Carolyn Warmus.
Carolyn Warmus was drop dead gorgeous.
Beautiful woman, intelligent.
She was a millionaire who dressed like a supermodel.
She wore magnificent clothes.
Whatever she wanted, she got. Except the man of her dreams. And getting him would be murder. Sex, Style, and Fatal Attraction, next on Snapped.
And this one's a little bit different, I think, because she is a millionaire heiress. And the other ones, you know, were like, most of them in this season have been like
married into money type of thing.
Yeah, either married into money or, you know, their moms, they quote-unquote have it all, and blah, blah, blah. But she's, like, very young, totally privileged. I guess Kristen Rossum was kind of like that, but not to this level. I mean,
yeah, this is, she's like a bachelorette about town in New York City. Like,
yeah, she wore
Paris Hilton, that's hot.
Yeah, exactly. She wore, like, Versace, Prada.
I feel like one of the things that the narrator said that is just a complete faux pas is that she wore Versace skirts with Prada jackets. I'm like, I don't think that they would do that. It's like you wear one designer and that's it.
Oh, really?
I think so.
Okay.
From what I've seen on The Real Housewives anyway.
Oh, okay.
You stick to a designer.
Mm. So you can't wear your Louboutins with somebody else?
Can't you wear your Louboutins with your Juicy Cooters? It's not going to happen.
Yeah, that's coming from Tennessee. If you want to hear some interesting pronunciations of designers, we've got them all.
Yes, we do.
Yeah, I'm sure you can figure out who those are. But we have literally heard that in seriousness. These people said that, and I'm like, oh, what are you? Oh. Okay. You mean Juicy Couture? Like, I also went on a date with a guy who ordered a glass of Merlot. Yeah, he was like, I'll have a glass of the Merlot. And I was like, oh, no.
Like, even us country bumpkins know how to say Merlot at
least. Yeah, at least, yeah. Oh, man. All right, so we do talk to a juror, Rosalind Serber. She's a cute little old lady.
She is sweet.
Yeah, I like her. She's very, oh, this was so full of your accents that you love. The, like, very thick New York accents. We had tons of those.
I feel like she, I could see her, like, using a lot of, like, Yiddish, you know? Like, she'd be like, you know what she tried to go after? Bupkis.
Yeah, yeah. She said that Carolyn made her body look good and she carried it through. Tommy Lynn, the detective, said she looked like she stepped out of Vogue when she was dressed up.
They really, really...
Oh, yeah, yeah, playing it up. I mean, she did, I guess. Like, they showed a lot of pictures and it was very, like... So this is, what, the 80s? Yes. Early 90s? And, you know, so it's very, like... big, bulky kind of clothes or whatever, but you can tell that what she was wearing was like chic designer looking.
I feel like if you have seen the movie Working Girl, Sigourney Weaver's character in Working Girl, like, because that was in the 80s and she's very, very high profile, prominent, like has all kinds of like very expensive clothes and stuff like that.
Okay.
While it's not what I would choose to wear because I don't enjoy the silhouettes all the time of the 80s. It's just too boxy and big. Yeah. And yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, to each their own.
No? Sure, yeah.
Carolyn was born in 1964 in the wealthy area of St. Clair Shores, which was a suburb of Detroit.
They showed some images of that area or, like, video of it.
Nice.
Whoa. Yeah, it was, like, country club. The houses were ginormous, and they said that every house in that neighborhood was, like, over $600,000.
Yep, that's what Peter Moses,
for the 80s.
The reporter said, yep.
That's crazy. Like, now, that's kind of, I mean, that's everywhere, you know? Like, like in this area, if you go to, like, Williamson County, you know, that's average there. Like, you can't get anything under than, like, $500,000. But, holy moly, in the 80s?
Yeah, Peter Moses said that it was one of the most affluent areas in the country.
Yeah, not just in that area, in the whole country. We also meet a PI, Ralph Barbieri. And he said that Carolyn's father was a very successful insurance and real estate entrepreneur. All these people who make, like, so much money, I'm like...
It's real estate, always.
Yeah, and also, like, give me more details. Like, specifically, what does your day-to-day look like? Like, what are you doing here? What can I also do?
No, they specialize in new technologies.
I know, I feel like it's still so vague. They're like, he's an entrepreneur in insurance and real estate. Okay, there's, like, so many things that you could do. Like, tell me. I want to know.
I do know, again, back to the Real Housewives. I swear I talk about other things other than just Real Housewives. But
do you?
Everything that I've been saying has determined that that is, in fact, a lie. But one of the Real Housewives, she became a millionaire from starting her own life insurance company.
How do you even do that?
No idea.
That's insane. Yeah. Like, who has enough money to do that? I don't know. I personally don't know how most insurance actually works. Like,
because it's not real.
Yeah, that's just who I am as a person. I don't believe in it. So,
it's like, it's not real.
Yeah, whatever. Her parents divorced when she was 6, and her dad pretty much, like, his life was his work. He didn't pay any attention to her. He didn't spend time with her. He just bought her stuff. And she got whatever she wanted. And Dr. Diana Falkenbach said, you know, kids who were born into privilege or born rich tend to get their way. And when they don't, they tend to act out. So then the parents reward that behavior by giving them what they want anyway.
Exactly. Like, hey, hush, here, here.
Exactly. Quiet. So then they grow up being, she said, like, a more aggressive type person, or having that tendency to be more like kind of a jerk to get what you want. And, like, you're conditioning them to do that, basically.
I've met people like that.
Yeah. Well, and it, like,
I'm like, you're just an adult brat.
Exactly. And it hit home for me, because there are times that, like, when my kids are just losing it. And so many times I'm just like, okay, make it stop, like, whatever. But you can't do that. Like, hearing that, I was like, okay, I have to stay strong. Like,
because you flash forward and 20 years later, you're like, oh gosh, I've created this monster.
Yeah, because you've told them, I mean, it's just like what they tell you when, like, your kid wakes up in the middle of the night or whatever, that if you keep going in there, like, even if you wait a really long time, and I'm talking, like, even if they're 7 months old, they understand, or they, like, have that programming or whatever. So if you're like, I'm not going to go in, and if there's something wrong with your kid, I'm not saying that, but, like, you know, you keep saying you're not going to go in, and then you finally do after, like, an hour, the only thing that the kid realizes is, all right, I just have to cry for an hour. Like, maybe they don't understand that concept of time, but they understand.
If I just keep on,
crying, work. Eventually they'll come in, and, like, you have to, you know, stand your ground sometimes. So her parents literally never did that. They were just like, have whatever you want. If for some reason we feel like we're going to try and teach you a lesson, don't worry about that. We'll change our mind if you just make a big enough stink.
Exactly. Please be quiet.
Exactly. Carolyn was smart, though, as well as wealthy.
And she had great looks. Everybody talks up and down about how great she looked.
Oh, my gosh. And I was like, maybe I just don't get, like, 80s hot.
I think that there are a lot of 80s hot that you would get, though.
I know, like, we talked about this yesterday, like, what, like, with the men, because we'll talk about the guy that she was obsessed with, but, like, everybody was like, he was this super hot, you know, teacher that she worked with and all this stuff, and I'm like, well, see, though, like, I don't know, but there's, you know, I was like, maybe I just don't get 80s hot, but then we named all these guys, like, Tom Selleck, Steve Guttenberg, I don't care who you are, you see him in the 80s, Billy Crystal was 80s hot.
Harrison Ford. Well, let's talk like 80s female hot. Suzanne Somers, hot.
Oh, totally.
Christie Brinkley, hot.
She's still hot.
Still hot.
Yeah. Who else? Was Sigourney Weaver hot?
I think so. I think a lot of people would say so.
Yeah.
I cannot
think. Farrah Fawcett?
Yeah. I can't think of her name for anything, but she was in Fast Times at Ridgemont High with the red bikini. Hot.
Hmm. I don't know who it is either, but yeah, there's definitely, you know, I guess I don't put Carolyn in that category. And like when you're wearing clothes that are 9 times bigger than you, it's just very hard. I don't know.
9 times.
Yeah. And her glasses are like as big as her whole face. It's like, how can you even see her? Like,
I don't know. Look.
Yeah.
You need to watch Gold Girls. You need to watch Working Girl.
Yeah, I've never seen that.
That'll ruin. I mean, it's laughable. The looks and the outfits and the makeup and the glasses. And that was after she had her makeover. That's all I'm going to say.
Oh, goodness. Okay. Carolyn got a degree in psychology from the University of Michigan, and then she got a master's degree in elementary education at Columbia University.
I mean, that's prestigious and very impressive.
Yeah, totally. She got her first job in 1987 teaching computer science at Greenville Elementary in Scarsdale. And the only thing I know about Scarsdale is when Ross was dating Rachel and Friends, and he was like talking about their future, and she was like, oh, I hadn't really thought about our future. And he's like, yeah, you know, we'll want to move out of the city because we'll have kids, and you know, probably Scarsdale, I think, would be a nice area and all this stuff. And she's like, I don't want 2 kids in Scarsdale. Like, I don't know what I want. I'm not ready for that or whatever.
But apparently Scarsdale is close enough to the city, so you could still go in and out. Or like Carolyn, you could live in the city and then work in Scarsdale. And it was a great place for your kids to grow up, for your schools.
It's like an affluent area.
Yes.
Yeah. You get paid well as a teacher.
I get why Ross wanted to move there.
Sure. Yeah. Like, now I understand.
Yes.
And Rachel...
It was, the walls were closing in on her. It was too much pressure.
Yeah. 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 So they said this was a coveted position because this is her first teaching job. She didn't have to start out at, like, you know, maybe some of these less desirable school districts or whatever and work her way up. She went right in there.
Yes.
Oh, I also thought it was funny, the like computer science at Greenville. I'm like, what is that in 1987? Like, what is computer science to them?
It's like the black screen with the green writing. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure, well, that would have been even more beneficial because you probably had to code everything. You know what I mean? Like, go in and be like.
That's true. Yeah.
It wasn't just you pop in a CD-ROM.
Yeah. Yeah. Because the computers were like as big as your house.
And you floppy disk, floppy disk, floppy disk.
So many floppy disks. At Greenville, though, she met a popular sixth grade teacher named Paul Solomon. And I don't know how they found this woman. Amy Steinman Cohen was in Paul's sixth grade class.
At some point in her, whenever she was in sixth grade.
Because she's a grown woman married with kids now. They talk to her. But, like, they went and found somebody who was a student of his. Like, I don't even know how. But she's like, you know, when you're a sixth grader, you idolize your teachers. And Mr. Solomon was one of my 2 favorite teachers. So, like, everybody, like, he was that teacher everybody wanted to have, I guess.
Yes.
And the PI, Ralph, said that Maul was like this macho. Maul. I think I said Maul.
I think you did.
Said that Paul was this, like, macho type guy. He drove motorcycles. He was in really good shape. He was involved in the phys ed department. And Carolyn was in awe of him. And I'll post a picture of him. I mean, you can decide for yourself. I'm not saying anything bad about him. It's just...
So here's what he reminds me of. The guy who plays the sheriff of Rottingham... from Robin Hood Men in Tights.
Yes.
Right? The hair, yep. The bone structure.
Uh-huh. Yeah, he totally does.
That's the vibe that I'm getting, and I am not latrine. I'm not into it.
Yeah, no. No. That's a great comparison.
Thank you.
Okay, so Paul's married. His wife's name is Betty Jean. They've got a teenage daughter, Kristen, and they live nearby in Ridgemont in an apartment.
Yes.
So Paul's 17 years older than Carolyn, and they said he immediately, quote unquote, took her under his wing. I was like, I bet he did.
And by took her under his wing, that roughly translates to put his P in her V.
100%.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, we're not... This ain't our first rodeo snapped.
We pick up what you're putting down.
Yeah. Dr. Falkenbach said that he served as a father figure for her. And I was like, absolutely no, he never did that. She saw him and was like, I'm going to do that guy. This was never a father figure for her.
Unless it's like a daddy issues type of thing.
I mean, I guess it could be. But she definitely was attracted to him from the get-go.
100%.
And, I mean, he's 17 years older, so what, she's around 20 at this time, so he's 37. Like, okay, hot, according to everybody, hot new teacher, starts at the school, it's her first year teaching, and he's like, yeah, I'll show you around, like, you can hang out with me, follow me around, like, it's like a tale as old as time. Of course, he ran after the hot young teacher,
mm-hmm.
like, you know, whatever.
Oh, yeah.
So... pretty soon, Carolyn is like one of the Solomon family. They said she would stop by their apartment for long chats with Paul and stay for dinner. I'm like, I don't like that.
Mm-mm.
She paid special attention to Kristen. And Rosalyn, the juror, said that she bought all kinds of gifts for his daughter and took her on trips.
Like skiing trips.
Yeah. And was kind of like this big sister role model for Kristen. Which
is so weird.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, okay, you have a new coworker. She's coming over for dinner all the time. She's hanging out. She's taking our daughter all kinds of places. Like, she's taking my daughter on trips. I don't know. I just don't know how comfortable.
If I was Betty Jean, I would be like,
Exactly. No way, Jose. But Carolyn would become way more than a daughter to Paul. Oh, then this was it. By the end of the school year, they were getting sweatier than gym class.
That's the one.
Ugh.
I was like, if it was that good, I must have written it.
Yeah. Yeah. That I was like, oh, there it is. Because, yeah, Tori and I were talking before we recorded this, and we were like, or she said, there wasn't as many, like, zingers from the
narrator.
And I was like, there was one, but I can't remember it. Yep, this was it.
That
sweatier
was it.
Than gym class. Yuck. It was not the first time that Paul had done this with another woman, but luckily his wife was understanding. So Rosalyn, the juror, said, she's like, there's just no question about it. They had an open marriage. And I was like, oh, okay, well, that's why.
Yeah, she said they spent the summers together, but the rest of the year they did whatever suited them.
I don't know what his wife did. Like, they didn't really talk about, of course, they didn't talk about her. I don't know what she did. For a living, or did she stay home or what? But yeah, it's like when he was teaching, I guess he still lived at home during that time because they said Carolyn would come by all the time and stuff like
that. Yeah, no, they lived together.
Yeah, so it's like just during the school year, it was an understanding that that's the time that you get to do whatever you want. Maybe because Kristen would be home during the summers, so.
Yeah. But honestly, from what I've gathered, and this is the 80s or early 90s, it's not the same, but watching the movie 7 Year Itch, which I love Marilyn Monroe, but that movie really got on my nerves because she's the, like, super sexy neighbor. And the guy, I don't know what his name is, but his wife and kid, they go off to, like, oh gosh, what is the Hamptons for summer or something? Because they live in New York City, right? So he's like, Bree, live at the train station and they go to the Hamptons for the summer. And after that, it's like for working men in New York City, the summers, that's the time that you can do whatever you want because the family's away. But you're in the city still because you have to work.
Mm.
But you're basically single.
Mm-hmm. Or like so Mad Men where flipped. Like they go
Absolutely.
Into the city during the week to work and it's like...
You have your apartment in the city.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, very frustrating.
Very. I don't like it.
Yeah, because those same men would get upset if their wives were seeing other people.
Well, we don't have enough time to get into that double standard.
Yeah, exactly. It's just, yeah, frustrating. Okay, so they have an open marriage. They do whatever they want. Paul considers this one of his casual flings. He does it all the time.
It's not that big of a deal.
And I guess, I mean, I don't know how you make an open marriage work. That's not who I am. Like, if both of you are fine with it, then fine. But, like, for me, I know personally that wouldn't work. But I guess it's just, like, because I've read stories, like, I don't know, in magazines about people who are, like, this is how we do, you know, this or that or whatever.
This is how we do it.
Basically, yeah. And I read, like, an article of one woman who was like, my husband and I have an open marriage, and our rule is that as long as it's not love, then it's okay.
But that's such a gray area, blurred line. Like, how do you know?
Yeah, exactly. So, like, yeah, as long as it's casual flings, as long as you're still, like, in your heart, I'm coming home to you or whatever, then do whatever you want.
It's just so sketchy. And then I've heard of some people who are like, you can't have an encounter with the same person twice.
Oh, okay, yeah. Yeah, you can't do, like, yeah. For them, this was their normal deal. And Paul is just like, young teacher, no biggie. I'm just having fun.
Exactly.
Carolyn, though, not just having fun.
No, that was a problem for her.
Yeah, she thinks this is going somewhere. This is a big deal to her.
And she's not used to hearing no, which we talked about earlier.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, what is she going to do when she's faced with no? She's going to flip out because she's used to then getting her way. So she's got to keep going on and on and on until she gets her way.
Yes.
And she was serious about Paul.
Deadly serious.
Man. On Sunday, January 15th, 1989, Paul's daughter Kristen was away on a ski trip. At 6:30 that evening, he left Betty Jean at home and headed down to the bowling alley. And when he returned 5 hours later, his life was turned upside down. The 911 call came in at 11:42 p.m., and it was Paul. I thought Paul was going to get killed.
That's what I thought, too. And I also thought, how can you spend 5 hours at the bowling alley?
You're like, there's something wrong here.
That didn't add up. That dog ain't going to hunt, because I love a bowling alley.
Sure.
I could bowl with the rest of them. On a school night for 5 hours at a bowling alley?
I don't know. I mean, maybe you're throwing the beers back. You got your buddies there. Maybe they're on a league. I don't know.
Yeah, like
5 hours style. Is a lot.
5 hours is a lot.
I think 2 hours is the max I can handle.
I'll even go three, sure. But five?
Five is a lot.
That's a part-time job.
Sure, yeah. Maybe he did have a part-time job there. Maybe he was like a bowling instructor. I don't know. When police got to the apartment, it was a grisly scene.
Betty Jean Solomon was found face up on the floor between a couch and a wall. There was a large amount of blood on her and on the area in which she was lying.
Betty Jean had been shot at close range 9 times.
Nine times.
Oh, gosh. If you can't tell, Tori's got a cold.
Surprise.
Yeah.
I was trying to go for a Ferris Bueller's Day Off thing when the principal calls the parents and they're like, he's been absent 9 times. And the parents like, 9 times? He's like, 9 times.
Investigators put together what happened at the apartment. Based on the wounds she sustained and the blood, she must have been fleeing around the apartment. So they're like, she's running around, trying to get away from this person who is
attacking her.
Yeah, obviously attacking her, trying to kill her. Dr. Peter DeForest, a forensic scientist, said it was very clear that she had been shot while she was on the floor. Bloody footprints on the back of Betty Jean's sweatshirt showed where the killer stood to shoot her.
That's terrible. That is terrible because she's wearing the sweatshirt. So they stood on top of her to keep her pinned down to shoot her.
That is so awful.
Oh my gosh. Like, how do you do this?
Yeah. It's so sad. For such a grisly scene, though, they said nothing was really disturbed. Like, nothing was knocked over. It didn't seem like anything was touched. You know, because they definitely need to look at the circumstances. Is this maybe a robbery gone wrong or, you know, whatever? Sure. So they're not thinking that's the case. And based on just everything that had happened, they're thinking this is someone who knew her. And the police obviously are going to not jump to the conclusion, but they've got to look at everybody close to her. So the first person they're going to look at is Paul.
Yes, because, I mean, anything that, if you're not a newbie to the true crime world, the husband is typically the one that is a suspect first. Like, oh, the husband did it.
Yeah, exactly. And we even have like a whole line of
merch.
Yeah, merch that says the husband did it because like it's such a true crime thing.
Yes.
Paul insisted, though, he didn't kill his wife. But during routine questioning, he was asked if he knew anyone that could kill his wife. And he's like, Carolyn Warmus, you need to look at her. He told police he went to the bowling alley to meet up with a buddy, but he didn't stay there. So he didn't spend that whole 5 hours bowling.
See, I know.
He then headed to a restaurant to meet up with Carolyn. William Ehrenwald, an attorney, said they had a few drinks. They went outside, got into her car, and had a sexual encounter in her car. Paul said that for over a year, he'd been carrying on an affair with her, but lately he'd been trying to break it off. And he said the more he tried to get out, the more possessive she had become.
Because that's her toy, and she's not going to watch anybody else play with it.
Yeah, no, mine.
Exactly.
I had it first. And he said that when he missed her birthday, she freaked out. And it's like, okay, Carolyn, he's not your boyfriend. Like, sorry.
Yeah, she's like completely missing the fact that he's actually married.
Yeah, it's so like Fatal Attraction.
That's exactly, there are so many ties drawn from Fatal Attraction to this because Fatal Attraction came out like 2 years before this murder.
Yeah, yeah. And she's just like, I mean, so much. Like, we haven't even scratched the tip of the iceberg with this lady. But yeah, there's just so much. And she's like concocting this much more serious relationship, like, in what, he's just not that into you? Like, I refer to him as my fiance to random people, like my dental hygienist. Like, yeah. That's, I think, what she's doing.
That's exactly what she's doing. She's so good close, it's not even funny.
Oh my gosh, yes. And Dr. Falkenbach said that there's a fear of abandonment with Carolyn. It could be, like, you know, a little bit of her history playing into it or whatever, but she's very much, like, trying to hold on to relationships.
Well, and when you get scared of losing something, you sometimes become very desperate. And in your desperation, you act ways that you never would normally act.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or for Carolyn, it might be in your character to act.
Yeah, I was going to say, or you act exactly how you always act, but, yeah. You know. But they said that Paul's, like, story and his grief seemed convincing. They said he legitimately just seemed, like,
broken up.
Yeah, a man who was, like, absolutely devastated that his wife had been killed. And he probably, you know, at this point, they're not sure that it's Carolyn, but if he thinks it could be her, he probably feels an immense amount of guilt for that, too.
Absolutely, I cannot even imagine.
Yeah. So the cops had a new suspect, and Paul had immunity as long as Paul cooperated. They brought Carolyn in for questioning, and she appeared shocked that something had happened to Betty Jean, but then she just wouldn't talk anymore after that. They subpoenaed her phone records, and several calls were made to a Manhattan PI named Vincent Parco. And they call him Vinny Parco, right?
Yeah, they do.
Yeah. They referred to him as swashbuckling. I'm like, what? Is he a pirate? That's the only thing I know about swashbuckling.
One thing, this is very off topic, but along the lines of, it has everything to do with pirates and nothing to do with this case.
Yes.
But I did hear somebody refer to someone who really enjoys drinking as like, yeah, I've got a wooden leg because it's like a pirate thing and they like to drink a ton. And they were like, oh, you think I've got a wooden leg? You should be my mom. She's the one with the wooden leg. And I'm like, oh, okay. I've never heard that before.
What does it mean? Just
that you just enjoy a drink.
Oh, because pirates like to drink.
Yeah.
Oh, I was thinking hollow leg, like how people say, like my in-laws always referred to my husband as having a hollow leg because he can just eat and eat and eat and he never gets full. And they're like, where does it
like
go?
Like your hump.
Yeah.
You put it in your hump like a camel.
Yeah. I was like, oh, so your wooden leg is filled with alcohol then?
I got confused. Yeah. Pirates like alcohol. Pirates have wooden legs.
So you
have a wooden leg if you like to drink a lot.
Got it. Okay.
No offense to pirates.
Or anybody with a wooden leg.
Very true.
Yeah. It's just sayings are weird.
Yeah. How they get started and how they continue.
Yeah. They said he had a very large ego and that he would overwhelm you.
Yeah, they said it was like a stereotypical PI who everyone looks up to. I don't really get it. He looks very much like that guy that's on that cop show, NYPD Blue.
Oh, yeah. He does.
Does he?
Yeah,
he does. God, I'm so good at this today.
You are. You're on it. So they talked to Vinnie Parco, and he gives police an interesting tidbit. He said that Paul was not the first married man that Carolyn had been obsessed with. She had hired him to follow one of her married lovers in New Jersey. But that's all he would say. But the police had something on this PI. They knew that he was in possession of a 25 caliber handgun, and it was not registered. And it was the same gun that killed Betty Jean. So, they tell him, we have dirt on you. We're going to nail you for this, unless you give us more information.
Yep, if you cooperate, you could have immunity.
I did not like that.
Me neither.
I was like, what? You give him immunity? Somebody who has possession of the gun that you know killed this woman? What if Carolyn hired him to kill her?
I know.
Like, are you serious? I was very not happy about that. Why would you give him immunity?
That was really sweet the way you said that. I was very not happy about that.
Yeah, I mean, I was watching it and I was like, I am not happy about this. I will let someone know.
I will be writing a letter.
Exactly. So he tells a story and he said that he'd had the gun, but then he gave it to Carolyn. Because she said she wanted a gun for protection, and then a machinist friend of his made her a silencer for it. You do not need a silencer if you need the gun for protection.
No, not at all. Why are you trying to silence something if you're not doing anything wrong?
Exactly. The friend that made the silencer was George Peters. Police never found the gun, but Peters said that he had test fired it with the silencer in place. In his shop, they found shell casings that perfectly matched the ones from the crime scene. But here's another thing. Did Peters ever say, I made the silencer for Carolyn? Or is he saying,
I made the silencer for that gun?
Yeah, or for Vinny. Like, Vinny ordered the silencer for the gun, and then Vinny gives it to Carolyn. Or did Carolyn go to him and say, I now have possession of this gun? Because they don't ever, they're not clear. The only link we have between Carolyn and this gun is Vinny says so.
Right, but the only reason why Vinny would want... Because I don't see a connection between Vinny and Betty Jean.
Right.
So yeah. Carolyn is the glue that holds them together.
Sure, yeah.
I see what you're saying.
Yeah, is Vinny the shooter?
Right.
And I don't know, they don't really get into the boot prints or whatever, or the footprints. Would they be Carolyn's size or Vinny's size? Like, I don't know, but it's just
there's a lot left to be desired for this case.
Yeah, for sure. And I just feel like you're just going on his word.
Which, I'm sorry, but I don't know if that's completely credible.
Right. And I mean, even if you talk to somebody who is really credible, you still have to verify it.
Yeah, you can't just be like, well, he told me so, and then just believe it.
And so the guy says, yeah, I made the silencer, but who did he give it to? Did Carolyn commission this, or did Vinny? I want to know. Police found other calls that Carolyn had made that fit into the puzzle. They were to a gun dealer in New Jersey the afternoon of the murder. When police visited the shop, the clerk remembered a blonde buying 25 caliber bullets. So that's definitely not Vinny. She showed them a phony ID. When they traced the ID back to a woman who worked with Carolyn 2 summers before that, they decided to go for an indictment. So
what a jerk. Yeah. I'm sure that woman was like, excuse me?
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Yeah, now wonder I'm like implicated in this murder.
Yeah, I wonder what all she used that ID for. Like, and what did this poor woman like drop it? And she was like, I kind of look like her. I'm going to use that for nefarious activities. Mm-hmm. Or did she steal it out of her purse? I wouldn't put it past her.
Right.
On February 2nd, 1990, Carolyn was arrested. Bail was set for $250,000 and her daddy paid it.
Daddy, I want it now.
Get me out of jail. Like, that's so much money. And he paid it.
Well, her dad, I mean, I'm sure they're like, chump change.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because of all of his new technologies or whatever. Police said they were confident they could convict Carolyn even without the gun. So her trial started on January 14th, 1991. In their opening statements, the prosecution laid out their evidence. They have her affair with Solomon, her link to Vinnie Parco, her connection to the murder weapon, and her trip to buy ammo. David Lewis, Carolyn's attorney, said there was not a single piece of evidence tying Carolyn to the murder.
But I feel like prosecution was like, remember what we just now said?
Yeah. I'm sorry, did you want me to say it again? Yeah. Did I stutter?
I don't know no other languages.
Yeah, I mean, sure, they didn't find her fingerprints at the scene or anything, but circumstantially, there's a lot there. Roslyn, the juror, said they didn't have the gun that killed her. There were no witnesses. No one saw her in that building. And when she said that, I thought, uh-oh, are we in trouble with a conviction here? In lieu of the direct evidence, the prosecution showed the jury a pattern of circumstances that showed Carolyn was guilty. So on the stand, Paul recalled Carolyn's obsessed nature about the relationship. But when he was cross-examined, the defense told Paul, but you will never be tried for your wife's murder because you've received immunity. And he, of course, had to say that, yeah, that's correct. And so the attorney was like, well, kind of blew his credibility out of the water. Then the prosecution turned to Vinnie Parco. So Vinnie knew about the gun. He sold the gun. The gun was the caliber and type used in the crime. The defense had a field day with that. And I'm sure, I mean, they should. They Vinnie's have to. Like,
the perfect joke witness to be on the stand, you know? Like, I'm sure they're like, oh, like cracking their knuckles. Like, woo, get out of the way, guys. I'm ready for this one.
Yeah, exactly. Because Vinnie on the stand was all over the place. And he was like,
he was just lying and like telling all of these outrageous stories.
Yeah. And the defense called him on it. And it made him, I mean, look like an idiot.
Yeah.
The worst testimony against Carolyn, though, was about her past relationships. So she had a habit of wanting men who were unavailable to her. And when she couldn't have the man she wanted, she stalked him.
That's, I mean, who hasn't been there, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's like, is there another way to...
I don't know how else to take rejection.
Yeah.
Other than stalking.
Exactly. It's just a standard reaction.
Yes.
Peter Moses, the reporter, said that he found the originals to threats she made to a guy that she fell in love with in college. So he was engaged to be married at the time, and he had to get a restraining order to keep her from him and from coming to the wedding. And then there was the married bartender who Carolyn had hired Vinnie to follow. Oh my God, this was so weird. She wanted the photographer to take photos of various stages of undress of her. So she's trying to do this like almost like boudoir session or whatever. But then she wanted that photographer to superimpose pictures of the bartender
into the photos of her boudoir shoot.
Yeah.
To make it look like they were carrying on this affair, which never happened.
Right. Yeah, she's trying to make it look like he's actually there with her. She's undressed. Like, she's trying to make it, oh my God, it's so weird.
And then to send it to his wife.
Yeah. What a jerk.
That's literally, like, crazy single white female fatal attraction.
Totally.
And I can't imagine, like, I mean, okay. Affairs happen. They are not okay, no matter who you are. It's never okay. But they happen. But I'm sure as a man, if you go into it, you're like, you know what? this happened, whatever, my bad, I'm gonna cut it off. And then you come across somebody like Carol and Warbus, you're like, oh no, this is really bad. Like, there's so much regret.
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, yeah, there is some instability there.
Yes. I'm sorry I sound stupid, by the way.
Oh, your voice. Because of the cold. I thought you meant like stupid, the things I'm like saying. Not smart. Yeah. And well, I was like, I don't think that goes without saying. But just because she had a thing for married men didn't mean she was a killer, right? Over 4 months, the trial finally boiled down. On April 17th, 1991, the jury was ready to deliberate, and 10 days later, they returned. That, I feel like, is a bad sign.
Yeah.
And it was. It was a hung jury.
Ugh.
Yeah. 1 year later, she was tried again, and the trial was basically the same, except for a new key piece of evidence, a black cashmere glove.
Only a very wealthy person would have cashmere gloves for a crime.
Exactly. Know? Yeah. Like, we're not talking about latex gloves.
Or even that leather glove from OJ.
Yeah. Like, which that one was expensive too, but sure, still. Sure. Yeah.
But still, you know what I mean? I mean, but he was wealthy, so.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's like you, there's only a certain type of person, I guess, that would, yeah, go to a murder and they're going to think to wear gloves a lot of the time. But the type of gloves being cashmere, you're like, okay. who could that be? Right. I don't think Vinny wore a cashmere glove.
I can't see it, but I don't know.
I mean, I guess, yeah, yeah. During the first trial, no one could locate the glove. During the second trial, the glove materialized. Paul said he found the glove in a box of old clothes 3 years after the murder.
And also, when going back to Vinny and the gloves, I don't think that he would wear a women's size small
right.
black cashmere glove unless he's like Charlie Day's uncle that has very tiny baby hands.
Yeah, and he has to wear the like, get his big plastic hands or whatever. Like, got new hands, look at him. But the DNA evidence could not identify the blood on the glove. Carolyn denied ever owning the gloves, but a receipt found by police showed otherwise. There was a receipt where she used a credit card to purchase those gloves.
In her name. Like, it's got Carolyn Warbus on it.
Yeah. Like, hello, when you use daddy's credit card, there is a paper trail.
Exactly.
Like, come on. So, the jury took... But I guess I'm wondering, the police obviously missed this at the crime scene.
Oh, yeah. But in the crime scene photos, you could see the glove.
So, why did they not take it?
No idea.
That's a blunder. That's so stupid.
That's a good word. That is a blunder.
Well, I don't know of any other way to characterize it.
Sure.
The jury this time only took 6 days to reach a verdict, which is still a long time. But I guess compared to the 10, it's less. They found Carolyn guilty in the second degree. At a sentencing hearing on June 26, 1992, the judge called the crime a merciless slaughter and gave Carolyn 25 years to life in the Women's Correctional Facility in Bedford, New York. Oh, and also the juror at one point, Rosalyn, that they talked to, she was like, oh yeah, and every man in the courthouse there was not one man that wasn't staring at her. I'm like, why? She looks, I don't know.
Yeah.
She looks frumpy to me.
Yeah, I don't get it. One time she was wearing this like peach kind of colored outfit with like a hat, and I thought she looked nice there.
Yeah, that was pretty. Yeah. But that's, yeah, I could see that it was like chic. Just, I don't know.
Not for you.
Yeah, not for me. According to the show, because this was in 2004, said Carolyn Warmus will be eligible for parole in 2017. Paul Solomon still lives in the apartment where Betty Jean was murdered, and he still teaches the same sixth grade class at Greenville Elementary. Kristen Solomon is now married with children of her own. But Tori did some googing because... You know, this was...
We gotta update it.
Yeah, right? We needed to update.
And this is from June 2019.
Carolyn was denied parole in 2017, but was granted parole and released on June 17th, 2019. When asked by the parole board when she was released what she would say to Betty Jean if she could, she said, I mean, my heart just goes out to the family, and I know at trial, her husband and her daughter testified, and they did not express any love or concern towards the victim or the fact that she's dead. She also said, I mean, I lost my parents and I lost loved ones, and it's heart-wrenching, and I honestly can't imagine what the victim's parents and siblings are going through. She said, nobody should have to go through something this tragic, and my heart just goes out to them.
So absolutely no responsibility.
Uh-uh.
And kind of just attacking Paul and Kristen.
Yeah, because she's saying that they don't care. There are words I want to say that we have agreed not to say on this podcast, so I'm just not going to do it.
Yeah, can't say anything nice. Don't say anything at all.
Well, then I better be quiet.
Yeah.
Because there is not one nice thing I can think to say about this person. To say that about Paul and Kristen, I mean. And then she's like, I mean, I've lost people. Look at how my life has changed.
It's all about her, obviously. Uh-huh.
Yeah, 25 years in prison did not do anything to teach her any lessons about, you know, being an actual good human being.
And yeah, the world not revolving around you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally still does. What a jerk. So that's season one, man.
Can't wait to get on into season two.
I know. And we're going to take a two-week break before we come back for season two. So come back on Monday, September the 14th. That's when we'll drop Snap Season 2, Episode 1. And if you're not already subscribed to the show, make sure you subscribe, because in case we want to, like, maybe give you a little gift to drop it early or something. I mean, just never know. So you want to make sure you don't miss it.
Yeah, so you need to stay tuned to see what we have to offer.
Exactly. And we will see you in a few weeks.
Thank you so much for listening. Bye.
Bye.